Welcome, everyone, to the last episode of Hashtag SDR Ask for the year.
Oh, I'm glad you put the final qualifier on there, Amy. Yeah, what a year this has been. But, you know, we prayed as we started that we would acquit ourselves well in this broadcast and bear fruit that remains. It's been a very challenging year for a lot of people. And I know, as I've mentioned to you before, it's always a highlight for me each week when we're recording these things. I hope and trust that this is a highlight for those who are listening too, as an encouragement. So we finish strong here, you and I, Amy, on behalf of our good friends who listen.
Yes, thank you for sticking with us through this year. Of course, what else have you had to do except listen to podcasts in the room alone? So
yeah,
we're glad to give you something to listen to. And yeah, hopefully everything will be back to normal very soon. So let's get right into the questions, Greg.
All right.
Here's a question from David. How do I explain to an atheist who rejects the Bible because it contains miracles? She just refuses to countenance it as having any historical credibility.
Well, this is going to be very difficult. And the reason is this person has made up her mind before she looks at the evidence. Now, this reminds me, by the way, of something that J. Warner Wallace does when he gives his presentation on the resurrection. And the first time I saw this, I mean, it was so cool. I couldn't believe it. I just like, oh my gosh, one of those kinds of things. Because at the end, he had already given all of these obstacles to a natural explanation of what's called the minimal facts argument. The minimal facts are that Jesus died on a cross. And when I say minimal facts, these are the facts that virtually every historian agrees with. And I mean, almost 100%, those who are professionals in this field, regardless of their personal convictions, okay, agrees that this is well attested. These four facts are well attested to in the New Testament. And I developed this in The Story of Reality. So the argument is there as well. And the person who's done most of the work on this is Gary Habermas. So you can find it in his books too. But it's become a very popular presentation because it's so powerful. There are four facts that are details that they all agree with. One is that Jesus died on a Roman cross, was buried. Two, the tomb was empty 3 days later. Three, the disciples claimed, no, let me back up. The disciples believed they had encountered the risen Christ. It's not just that they claimed it. Historians aren't saying that they claimed it. They're saying they actually believed it. And the reason is because they were willing to die for what it is they believed actually took place. So they're not inventing it, you know, kind of deal. And the fourth is that even skeptics like James and hostiles like the Apostle Paul encountered the resurrected Christ, and it changed them to the point of their willingness to be martyrs for their convictions. And so those four facts, then they said, what are the explanations? And so you can come up with all kinds of non-supernatural explanations. Jesus didn't really die. He was revived in the tomb. For example, that's the swoon theory. The disciples stole the body. That's where it went. The disciples were hallucinating. This is why they thought they saw Jesus. These are explanations, and he deals with each one of them individually. So on a graph, I mean, on a graphic on the screen, you know, he's his magnificent screen presentations. I hesitate to call them PowerPoint because they look like, you know, highly well-produced moving films behind him, whatever. But he's got this thing, it's two roads. And one says resurrection, the other one says naturalistic explanation. But on the road that goes to naturalistic explanation, he's got these barricades, everyone he's put up. Here's why it's ridiculous to think Jesus didn't die. He goes through all the medical evidence. Here's why it's ridiculous. So he deals with all of the alternate naturalistic explanations for these particular details, okay? Those are all obstacles to a naturalistic explanation of the commonly accepted facts. Okay. Then he says, what are the obstacles for believing that a resurrection actually took place as the best explanation for these particular well-attested facts? And he says, the only obstacle is that somebody doesn't believe in miracles. And then he says, and the skeptic is the one who put the obstacle there. That was the part that got me. When he did that, I thought, oh, gosh, you put that there. All right. So that isn't an actual obstacle to the argument, to the facts, to the details. That is an invented argument. I'm sorry, an invented obstacle that you have manufactured. Okay, so that's the circumstance that the atheist that David is talking about is in. She has invented an obstacle, and she says there are no miracles. Okay, based on what? This is the reasonable people. This is the rational people. These are the so-called brights. Okay, then what is your reason that there are no miracles? Well, we just don't have any good evidence for miracles, they might say. Kind of take David Hume's argument, it's too extreme. Wait a minute. We just gave you a whole bunch of evidence for a particular miracle, which you have rejected because you believe that are no miracles a priori before the facts are in of any given miracle because there's no evidence for miracles. So you have a massive circular reasoning going on here, an assumption that is immovable, okay? Now, if you have a immovable belief, like some would say, I have an indestructible faith or immovable faith, but it's based on falsehood, that means you've got an immovable fantasy, and that's what we have here. You can't deal with that. If a woman says, or a man, or anybody says, I refuse to believe any evidence of any kind because I've already drawn my conclusion before I've seen any evidence. Now, that is the height of irrationality from a person, the kind of person who enshrines rationality as their their God, so to speak.
Yeah, Greg, I think the question that you asked in the midst of that is the perfect one to start with. Why do you reject miracles? Because they're going to have to say, because there is no God. Okay, so what you're telling me is you can't accept miracles as evidence for God because miracles can't happen because God doesn't exist. I mean, if it's possible to help, and I know it's not possible for everyone, but if it's possible to help her to see how circular her reasoning is, because you're exactly right, Greg, this is a massive circular reasoning. If you can possibly help her to see that, it might make a difference. It might not. But if you can get the point across that miracles happened in history, if something happened in history, then that's the kind of thing that you can investigate. You can investigate historic happenings. You can investigate whether or not Jesus lived, he died, and then he was alive again. However you want to explain that. Those are things that you can look into because they're historical things. And Greg, you always mention, is it Craig Keener's book, The Miracles?
Yes, I was going to mention that as well. It's a two-volume set. And what he does is he starts from, antiquity, and he moves forward into modern times. And the way he deals with David Hume's argument, and David Hume's argument is compelling to a lot of people, the philosopher from the early 19th century, had a great impact on people. And David Hume says miracles are the kind of thing that would be so rare you are never justified in believing them because rejecting the miracle is the odds-on favorite in every case. Okay, well, that's all things being equal, but all things aren't equal. Because sometimes the evidence for any particular one is overwhelming, and you have to look at the individual evidence for any particular claim. And then he chronicles two volumes of the footnotes they're not endnotes, they're footnotes. And the footnotes lots of times are like more on the page than the regular text. It's unbelievable. And what he's shown is that miracles are not as rare as people think. In fact, if you ask in any church congregation for people to raise their hand if they have experienced a genuine miracle properly qualified in their lives, you're going to get dozens of hands of people who have experienced that. You know, and then the alternative is to say, well, no, that didn't happen to you. You don't know what you're talking. I know what happened to you better than you know what happened to you, okay, because I've already decided that miracles don't happen. I mean, that's just crazy. What's interesting about the minimal facts argument, Amy, is that no individual fact is in the least wise supernatural. A dead man, an empty tomb, men that claimed they saw something, and changed minds. But when taken as a whole and looking at individually the circumstances, they become very, very powerful and compelling, because the only answer that makes sense of all of the facts there, that's just the minimal facts, by the way, there's a lot more.
That are
is that Jesus
upon.
Yes, right. And it's those are the ones that have the highest degree of agreement. Then others have lesser degree of historical agreement of historians, but the four is all you really need to make your case, the ones that are pretty much universally acknowledged to be so. And the ones where there's the less a lower amount of agreement is the empty tomb. But of course the answer to that is if the tomb wasn't empty, this is how you stop the resurrection nonsense to begin with, because there were lots of people who wanted to stop it. Like the Jews, like the Romans, like everyone in power, all they had to do is say, here is the body, okay? So anyway, the evidence is overpowering, and you don't have to believe in miracles to accept any particular piece of evidence, because there's nothing supernatural about any piece of evidence. But they add up to what is the best explanation? That's the question. That's the inductive reasoning part.
And just to clarify about the minimal facts, because I think a lot of people are confused about what we're claiming. We're not claiming that these facts are true because all of these experts say so. That's not the claim we're making. What we're saying is that there's enough evidence for these facts. It's just a shorthand. There's enough evidence for these facts that all of these scholars, critics, Christians, non-Christians, whatever, agree to. Because the evidence is there. Now, you can go and look at that evidence, but this is just a shorthand to say, look, these are things that they're not objecting to. So these are aspects of the Bible that they're not even objecting to because there's good evidence. So if you want to look at that evidence, that's also available. But this, again, just shorthand.
I'm so glad you said that, because this isn't argumentum ad populum. Most scientists believe, so it must be right, okay? We are saying most historians believe these individual facts because there's good reason for them to believe it. And the interesting thing in this case is many of these historians reject the resurrection but acknowledge the facts. So they're somewhat hostile witnesses. That is, they have no inclination to affirm the individual fact given their own personal beliefs. It's contrary to their beliefs to affirm the fact if it wasn't well justified, because it seems to suggest something happened that they don't want to believe. So that strengthens the case of the minimal facts argument. Thank you for making that point, though. They believe these things for good reasons. And these are the things that any apologist will go through. And I do there in the book of in the story of reality, in the chapter on the
right.
Resurrection.
It's just a way of starting. I mean, we could start at the very beginning for all the evidence, but it's just a way of starting the argument a little bit later, because perhaps a person will say, okay, if skeptics have looked at this and they agree to it, then you don't have to convince me of that. We'll start at this point. So that's kind of how it's used. But to get back to this question, I think a good way to start would be to say, again, why do you reject miracles? And then if miracles happened in history, then we should be able to see evidence for them. Are you open to hearing evidence for a miracle? Would that change your mind? Now, at that point, they'll have to either state the fact that they won't accept anything because there's no supernatural, therefore there's no miracle. Then eventually, you know, even after you present your historical evidence, they will likely say, Yes, but that's never going to be the best explanation because there's no God. Aha! So your problem isn't miracles. Your problem is that you don't believe God exists. And now that you can start talking about that more core issue, which is really the issue here.
Yeah, but you're running to, but I think what in that discussion, at least at that point, you're going to run into the same problem. But what the Christian has done, what Dave has done, is at least put it all on the table. This has nothing to do with evidence. When I say you're going to be back to the same, to the beginning again, is they're going to say there is no evidence for God. And you give them evidence for God. They say, well, that's not evidence because there is no God. So it's going to be the same circularity that you're going to run into. But at least it's all out of the table. And David could say, okay, well, thank you. You've made your point very clearly. And your point being that you have already decided a priori. That means before the evidence is in, particularly the evidence of our senses, you know, and that there is no God, and therefore there could be no miracles, and therefore there could be no resurrection. This has nothing to do with rational thinking. Thank you for clarifying it. It has to do with what you've decided to believe out of the gate, and you won't budge on that. So there's not much more I can say.
That's great, Greg. That's a great summary. Yeah. Well, hopefully, I mean, and you never know. Maybe God will open her eyes. Maybe you never know. Our role is to present the truth as clearly as we can, and that's always valuable because we are glorifying God by presenting the truth, even if they reject it.
That's,
you know,
right.
I think about I've just been reading Ezekiel, and God told Ezekiel, I want you to go and I want you to tell them these things. And they're not going to listen to you. But here are all the things you need to tell them.
Mm.
And I imagine, you know, sometimes I feel like that.
Thanks a lot.
You know, is it worthless? Was it worthless for Ezekiel to announce all those things from God? No, because speaking the truth glorifies God. And that is why we are here. And God will use it however he decides to use it. And so never feel like it's pointless, because it's not pointless. It's what we're called to do, to glorify God, to speak the truth about him. So see what God does with it. Maybe he'll open our eyes, maybe he won't, but it's still worth it.
And by the way, no one ever knows what God is actually going to do with any resistant sinner, to put it simply, skeptic. And even though it doesn't look like anything's getting through, the testimonies are legion of those who say, yeah, I was an atheist, and I heard this, this, and this, and totally resisted. However, and there's a stone in their shoe, right? And then God started to use it.
Yeah, people are listening, and they're thinking about it later on, even if they're not changing their mind at the time. They will think about it later on. So never give up. Okay, Greg, let's do one more. Here's one from No Name. What do you think of churches requiring liability waivers to attend worship services?
Well, I presume that's in light of the politics of COVID. My presumption is.
Yeah, I would
presume
that.
Because I'm trying to remember that there was some event where that was the case that I was part of in the last few months. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I think it's entirely legitimate. I have no problem with that. My whole view on this is that you protect the vulnerable, and people who aren't particularly vulnerable, which is the vast majority of the population. When I say vulnerable, it doesn't mean they can't get sick, but they're not going to die of it. And we get sick of lots of things and get over it, you know. Then let them decide for themselves. But the liability is that if a church opens up with that mentality, okay, you guys, everybody come. If you don't want to come, you don't have to. But we're going to have our service. Whoever will may come. Then somebody gets sick, they can blame the church and there's be a lawsuit. I mean, you know how people are litigious these days. And so to protect themselves, the people who attend offer a waiver that they are coming with the full acknowledgement that they may be putting themselves at risk to get something. You know, they might catch a cold, for goodness sake, or the flu or COVID, but they're willing to take that risk and not hold the church responsible. That actually was something I recommended early on with regards to churches opening up. This is a way of them opening up and protecting themselves from what I would view as a frivolous lawsuit under those circumstances. So I have no trouble with it.
I have probably a different perspective on this somewhat, because I can absolutely see, Greg, I can absolutely see people suing the church if they get sick because the church opens up and they don't want to take responsibility for their own actions. But the fact that I would say if you feel like that's necessary in your church, that's already an indication of a big problem in your church.
Well, keep in mind, though, the church is wide open, whoever will may come. And so you have a full range of people. It isn't just the inner core of disciples or deeply committed people. It's people that are all over the map. You've got the wheat and you've got the tares, Jesus said. So I think that takes into consideration the fact that even normal churches are going to have, even healthy churches are going to have those kinds of people that might be there.
Would you make a distinction between the members and people visiting then?
No. And the reason is because membership, well, I guess it all depends on what membership means in any individual group or congregation. I think that genuine followers of Christ are not going to sue the church if they get sick, okay? But the church is not filled only with genuine, even the best of churches, you know, were filled with those kinds of people. And that's why I just think it's a common, I don't think it's a reflection personally on the circumstances of the church, that the church is aware that this is a liability. And by the way, all it takes is a couple of visitors, you know. And then what? And then the whole church suffers. So I just think it makes sense. But I mean,
so what do you? So I can't help but think of 1 Corinthians 6, where Paul tells them not to sue other believers,
right,
for the sake of the way that appears to the world. So he says, actually, then it is already a defeat for you that you have lawsuits with one another. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be defrauded? On the contrary, you yourselves wrong and defraud. You do this even to your own brethren. Mm-hmm. So that would obviously be against any Christian in the church suing the church, obviously. Mm-hmm. But that principle of kind of even opening yourself up to that by having this liability waiver and saying that people in the church might sue me, do you think that is a bad representation of the church to the world?
No, I don't think so. And partly for the reasons I offered. And also in Corinthians, Paul says that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit, so don't corrupt the temple. And he's talking about sexual sin. Yet there are people in the church that commit sexual sin. These are exhortations about what they're supposed to do, but that doesn't mean everybody's going to follow it, you know. So I'm sympathetic to your sensitivity about this. This seems like we're saying, yeah, Paul said don't do it, but people are still going to do it, so we're going to protect ourselves. And under this circumstance, I think the liability is high that people would do that. Especially, keep in mind, especially when we have a culture that has a lot of innate sense hostility towards Christianity, and they set themselves up in circumstances so that they can go after Christian organizations and hurt them. We have seen this happen, okay? And so just so they can get a lawsuit and they can shut somebody down. It's a very vicious group out there. And so this is, one could argue that this is more a protection from outsiders, not from those who are genuine Christians. But they are all welcome in our congregation and in our meetings together. So
would you say that this in general, let's say this is not, we're not in the situation we're in now. Would you say that this is more for something like this explosive, this politically intense situation? Or do you think that this would be acceptable anytime?
Well, I don't know why at any time it would be wrong for, okay, given Paul's exhortation that you just read, why would it be wrong for the church to say, will you obey that exhortation? Will you promise to obey that exhortation? That's really what it amounts to. If you don't promise to obey that exhortation, then we don't, frankly, we don't want you hanging around making us vulnerable. But if you agree to obey Paul's exhortation, that's all that is, then we're fine.
Well, now that you put it that way, Greg, it makes a lot more sense to me. That puts it in a whole different light, because now what was uncomfortable for me is the idea of bringing a state-sponsored legal action into the church. But when you're doing it as if you're coming into our congregation, you have to agree to abide by this Christian principle. Now, that I can get behind.
Great. All righty.
All right, everyone. Well, we gave you an extra long episode for the last one of the year, so I hope you enjoyed that. And again, please keep sending those questions through Twitter with the hashtag STRask. And if you like the show, we'd love it if you would review on iTunes. And those reviews always help other people to find our show. So we'd love it if you would do that for us. And we'll keep talking so you can listen. So anyway, thank you for your questions. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.